Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Here is the latest news of a world at war, reported by NBC staff members on duty at home and overseas. First, we take you to London for the report of John McVane.
This is London.
RAF bombers last night attacked the Ruhr and Rhineland regions of Germany and laid mines in enemy waters. 8 bombers are missing. The passage of 2 convoys through the Mediterranean to Malta and Tobruk is regarded as a limited success in London. It said that certain supplies have got through, although at a considerable loss. This time of year, it's noted, the weather conditions and the short nights favor air attack. Authoritative quarters in London today don't believe there's any material change in the Libya situation. The attacks on the Cromer and El Adem have stopped. Today's official report says Allied forces yesterday broke up an armored attack on city Rezeg and repulsed attacks on the Cromer, southwest of Tobruk. Dispatches reaching London today indicate Rommel is trying to encircle Tobruk. Rommel is said to have lost heavily, but he's thought to have big reserves. The British are disappointed with the course of the Libya battle. They'd hoped that this time Rommel would be finished off once and for all. Instead, the British army has been thrown back on Tobruk, and the defense of Egypt again becomes a pressing problem. The two armies were roughly equal in size, 2 corps apiece. But from correspondence reports, the balance of armored power now seems to be tipped well in favor of Rommel. The Times military expert today emphasizes the setback in the Caldron area when concentrated British tank units ran into a heavy concentration of anti-tank artillery. The tanks may have been caught without their customary outlying screen of armored cars and other light mobile units that should uncover and send warning of such traps. There's a thread of hope in some of the dispatches reaching London that General Ritchie may be able to do the unexpected. But most reports indicate the British are preparing for a grim defense of Tobruk and, if possible, the land communications running to Egypt. Some of the British commentators are trying to analyze the failure to defeat Rommel. One of them talks about the sudden appearance of the German 88mm guns, which he considers better than the British 25-pounder. This seems like a simplification of the problem, because the British gun is an excellent gun with plenty of distance and wallop, and Americans who've used it here think it's a fine piece of artillery. The difficult position in Libya now is almost bound to affect plans for a second front. If the British could have cleared the African coast and opened the Mediterranean, we'd have had a real springboard to move into southern Europe. Now we have a problem that will keep calling for more ships, tanks, and planes if we want to save Africa, the whole Middle East, and India. I've never seen General Auchinleck's forces, but I've seen a good deal of the British Army that send him his men and material. On the basis of that, you can make a few deductions about his handicaps. In the first place, the British tank force, from which he had to draw, was fine for defending the small area of Britain against anything the Germans were likely to send over here. In the year 1940-41, the keynote of the British Army was defense. But the tanks were too lightly armed and otherwise unsuitable to cope with Rommel's heavy tanks in the great stretches of the Libyan desert. Secondly, the RAF hasn't yet come out with any plane that will effectively deal with German tanks. The RAF is well equipped to fight defensive air battles or carry out long-range bombing offensives. But the weakness of the link between Army and Air Force that's apparent enough in maneuvers becomes plain to the public in every major land battle. Ritchie had a certain number of American tanks that were suited to fight the German tanks in the desert. The trouble seems to be that he didn't have enough. There's nothing wrong with the men of the British Army. Man for man, they're probably as good as any of their opponents. They've usually lost battles because they didn't have the right equipment in the right place and at the right time. It's difficult, too, to say anything against the RAF as a force. They can outfight the Luftwaffe, but they've never been given the right weapons and trained in the job of working as an integral part of the Army. In the last year or so, the British Army has been learning offense. But it takes time to build tanks and the other weapons they'll need for attacking the continent. And until an army commander can have under his command the dive bombers, fighters, and tank busters that can work as a part of his advance force, he'll be handicapped in attacking the Germans on a second or a third front. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
A first-hand account of what's happening this morning on the Eastern Front comes to us now from Moscow, Russia.
This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. Hitler's third all-out effort to capture Sebastopol began 11 days ago. The onslaughts during this period have been growing daily in intensity. Guns more monstrous than the Big Bertha have been pounding at the fortress. The Luftwaffe has been taking impossible advantage of its numerical superiority. German tanks keep crawling up to the trench lines, although hundreds of them have already been burned or wrecked. Division after division has been bled white by the defenders. And still, ever greater numbers of Germans and Romanians keep pressing. Even sappers and supply troops have been hurled against Sevastopol. Yesterday, at the southern gates alone, two divisions made six attacks. The first began at 4 a.m. The last was beaten off in the dead of night. On another sector, seven desperate attacks were thwarted. On a third, tanks were repelled by Russian soldiers throwing hand grenades and bottles with inflammable liquid from trenches 2 seconds after the tanks had rumbled over their heads. Every story coming from Sevastopol these days is a story of miraculous feats. But now, one's very existence there is an act of heroism. The population has been living underground since the 31st of May. There in the deep caverns, the men and women of Sevastopol work in shifts day and night, feeding the front with arms and ammunition. City traffic never quiets down. Trucks carrying munitions, fire brigades trying to catch up with the flames devouring the city. Field kitchens bringing food and water to the front lines and bomb shelters. Plumbers, electricians, communication officers. An endless stream of men and machines, speeding, hurrying, oblivious of the fact that they are writing a glorious chapter in the history of the human spirit.
Now let's switch to Australia for the news of the fighting on the Pacific front.
This is Martin of Grant Street, somewhere in Australia. 2.5 hours ago, in a nationwide broadcast from Melbourne, Australia's Prime Minister, John Curtin, outlined to the people of this nation one of the grimmest summaries of the war that has come in many weeks from the lips of an Allied statesman. The Prime Minister delivered his speech at 7:30 tonight, exactly 1 hour after the conclusion of a four-hour conference of the Allied War Council, which was attended by General Douglas MacArthur, his Chief of Staff, Major General Richard Sutherland, the Allied Land Forces Commander, Australian General Blaney, and American and Australian Army, Navy, and Air Chiefs of Staff. The Prime Minister took as the theme of his broadcast tonight the global nature of the war and the inescapable interdependence of every theater of action. Appealing for a 100% civilian war effort, Curtin stated, I quote, I say frankly, it is possible that Australia can be lost, unquote. Leading up to this statement, he missed no words in analyzing the Allied global position today. Referring to the Allied shipping losses, Australia's Prime Minister stated, I quote, losses of shipping, I tell you bluntly, are beyond our present annual replacement capacity, unquote. Speaking of the Middle East, Curtin frankly referred to the present position as a British setback, described the present stage of the fighting as critical, and concluded with a restrained but ominous comment. I quote his words, as I speak, the move from Libya is not good. Unquote. Of Russia, the Prime Minister spoke with equally unequivocal realism, saying first, I quote, the fate of Russia is in the balance, and then, Russia is fighting for her very existence. Going on to the Battle of the Coral Sea, Curtin referred with pride to the fact, revealed for the first time tonight, that Australian cruisers played a distinguished part. Adding up, however, the results of our three naval clashes with the Jap Pacific Fleet, the Prime Minister took his stand squarely in the ranks of the realists as opposed to the optimists. He said, these are his words, the combined effects of the Coral Sea, Midway, and the Lucian battles, while frustrating from the Jap point of view, is far from decisive in the struggle through which we must pass. If we are to reach our men locked up in Singapore, if we are to free the Netherlands East Indies, if we are to re-enter the Philippines, if we are to relieve China, and if we are to strike at the very heart of Japan, unquote. Taking up the Australian position, Curtin said he was satisfied that the importance to the Allied cause of Australia's defense was now fully recognized, where, I quote his words, it is vital that it be recognized, unquote. The Prime Minister did not neglect, however, to repeat, indirectly at least, the appeal for more force which is invariably included in all his speeches. Tonight, his reminder took the form of pointing out that the war can only be won and I quote his words again, if Australia's capacity to strike carries the full punching power that the Australian people and our allies can accumulate. To sum up, Curtin's speech tonight, while grim, is not defeatist. In responsible quarters here, it is regarded as an adequate, if not intentional, warning to Allied optimists above that the war here and elsewhere is still far from being won. This is Marvin Hosky, signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
And that winds up our reports from overseas, but waiting to report news from the home front is Earl Godwin in the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. I think the piece of news that probably covers more square mileage than any other one thing is the rubber drive, which heads up here in Washington. In the office of the Petroleum Industry War Council, the president put the job in the lap of the oil business, the gas filling stations particularly, and the oil business for once is a hero and not the goat of some trust buster's sharp-pointed attack. And so the general headquarters of the rubber drive is the office of Bill Boyd, Jr., Petroleum War Council Chief, and he says to me this morning that it's Utah against the rest of the country, as that state offers to outdo everybody else. More rubber per capita than from any other state, says Utah. Other states immediately take the dare. Vermont comes back with a reminder that while it ain't making much noise, remember that it's the still pig that gets the most sustenance. Colorado promises to pile up rubber higher than Pike's Peak, which, if I recall it, is over, well, how high is it? 15,000 feet or so? 5 miles high, or whatever it is. First report came from Lakeland, Florida. 15,000 pounds of scrap rubber from one single gas station dealer. And in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, good old state, they put out signs on some of the gas stations saying, if you don't bring any rubber, you'll get no gas. At Spencer, Iowa, and they listen in on this broadcast out there, there's a dealer who amassed 2 tons of rubber in one day, I believe. 3 little girls in Charlotte, North Carolina, waded down a stream and recovered 150 pounds of scrap rubber, including an old fire hose weighing more than 100 pounds. It's a terrible thing to throw rubber in these streams, but it's a great thing to recover it. Everybody seems to have the same idea on this one thing, that is, turn in your automobile mats. The president made that suggestion, too, at his press conference yesterday, press and radio. And as I left that press and radio conference from the executive office of the White House, I tripped over a rubber floor mat 10 by 6 feet. How about turning that in, too, Mr. President? Out in Chicago, they've discovered a veritable vein of rubber on the near north side. It's 6 feet deep, 30 feet wide, 150 feet long, or something like that. It's an old scrap heap that had been undercover for years as a result of demolition of houses and some fires. They're turning up rubber as if it was a gold rush. Here in Washington, farm block senators are convinced more than ever surplus wheat and other agricultural products should be converted into rubber at once. Price Administrator Leon Henderson has been reliably reported to have told friends he's come to the conclusion it'd be better for him to resign. But it's reported also in congressional circles that the president feels that Mr. Henderson has done a very good job. Henderson, I believe, will be kept in his post despite severe criticism of his price policies. The president today appeals for a united effort on the part of all citizens for the establishment of a total physical and moral fitness in this war for survival, fitness for the freedom we cherish. The president sends that letter to Paul McNutt, chairman of the War Manpower Commission, and the president commends government and community efforts in improving health and in eliminating from the vicinity of camps and naval stations the red light districts. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And there you have the up-to-the-minute news as reported by John McVane in London, Robert Magadorf in Moscow, Martin Agronsky in Australia, and Earl Godwin from our own nation's capital. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.